"Remember, Werther," she added, "do not come again before Christmas Eve." He was about to make some answer when Albert came in. They greeted each other coldly, and with mutual embarrassment paced up and down the room. Werther made some trivial remarks, Albert did the same, and their conversation soon dropped. Albert asked his wife about some household matters, and finding that his commissions were not executed, he used some expressions which to Werther's ear savoured of extreme harshness. He wished to go, but had not power to move, and in this situation he remained till 8 o'clock, his uneasiness and discontent continually increasing. At length the cloth was laid for supper, and he took up his hat and stick. Albert invited him to remain, but Werther, fancying that he was merely paying a formal compliment, thanked him coldly, and left the house. Werther returned home, took the candle from his servant, and retired to his room alone. He talked for some time with great earnestness to himself, wept aloud, walked in a state of great excitement through his chamber, till at length, without undressing, he threw himself on the bed, where he was found by his servant at 11 o'clock, when the latter ventured to enter the room and take off his boots. Werther did not prevent him, but forbade him to come in the morning till he should ring. Monday morning, the 21st of December, he wrote Lotta the following letter, which was found sealed on his writing desk after his death, and was given to her. I shall insert it in fragments, as it appears, from several circumstances, to have been written in that manner. "It is all over, Lotta. I am resolved to die. I make this declaration deliberately and coolly, without any romantic passion, on this morning of the day when I am to see you for the last time. At the moment you read these lines, O best of women, the cold grave will hold the stiffened remains of that restless and unhappy being, who, in the last moments of his existence, knew no pleasure so great as that of conversing with you. I have passed a dreadful night, or rather, let me say, a propitious one. For it has given me resolution, it has fixed my purpose. I am resolved to die. When I tore myself from you yesterday, my senses were in tumult and disorder. My heart was oppressed, hope and pleasure had fled from me forever, and a petrifying cold had seized my wretched being. I could scarcely reach my room. I threw myself on my knees, and heaven, for the last time, granted me the consolation of shedding tears. A thousand ideas, a thousand schemes arose within my soul, till at length one last, fixed, final thought took possession of my heart. It was to die. I lay down to rest, and in the morning, in the quiet hour of awakening, the same determination was upon me. To die! It is not despair. It is conviction that I have filled up the measure of my sufferings, that I have reached my appointed term and must sacrifice myself for you. Yes, Lotta, why should I not say it? One of us three must die, and it shall be me. Oh, my dearest, this heart stirred by rage and fury has often conceived the horrid idea of murdering your husband. You, myself. So be it, then. And in the bright, quiet evenings of summer, when you climb the hill, let your thoughts then turn to me. Remember how often you have watched me coming to meet you from the valley. Then bend your eyes upon the churchyard which contains my grave, and by the light of the setting sun mark how the evening breeze waves the tall grass which grows above my tomb. I was calm when I began this letter, but the recollection of these scenes makes me weep like a child. About 10 in the morning, Werther called his servant, and whilst he was dressing, told him that in a few days he intended to set out upon a journey, and bade him therefore lay his clothes in order, and prepare them for packing up, call in all his accounts, fetch home the books he had lent, and give 2 months' pay to a few poor people who were accustomed to receive from him a weekly allowance. He breakfasted in his room, and then mounted his horse and went to visit the land steward, who, however, was not at home. He walked pensively in the garden and seemed anxious to renew all the ideas that were most painful to him. The children did not suffer him to remain alone long. They followed him, skipping and dancing before him, and told him that after tomorrow, and one day more, they were to receive their Christmas gift from Lotta. And they then recounted all the wonders of which they had formed ideas in their childish imaginations. "Tomorrow, and tomorrow," said he, "and one day more." And he kissed them tenderly. He was going, but the younger boy stopped him to whisper something in his ear. He told him that his elder brothers had written splendid New Year's wishes, such large letters, one for Papa and another for Albert and Lotta, and one for Herr Werther too, and they were to be presented early in the morning, on New Year's Day. This quite overcame him. He made each of the children a present, mounted his horse, left his compliments for Papa and Mama, and with tears in his eyes, rode away. He returned home about 5 o'clock, ordered his servant to keep up his fire, desired him to pack his books and linen at the bottom of the trunk, and to place his coats at the top. He then appears to have made the following addition to this last letter to Lotta. "You do not expect me. You think I will obey you, and not visit you again till Christmas Eve. Oh, Lotta, today or never! On Christmas Eve you will hold this paper in your hand. You will tremble and moisten it with your tears. I will. I must. Oh, how happy I feel to be determined." In the meantime, Lotta was in a pitiable state of mind. After her last conversation with Werther, she found how painful to herself it would be to decline his visits, and knew how severely he would suffer from their separation. She had, in conversation with Albert, mentioned casually that Werther would not return before Christmas Eve, and soon afterwards Albert went on horseback to see a person in the neighbourhood with whom he had to conclude some business which would detain him all night. Lotta was sitting alone. None of her family were near, and she gave herself up to the reflections that silently took possession of her mind. She was forever united to her husband, whose love and fidelity she had proved, to whom she was heartily devoted, and who seemed to be a special gift from heaven to ensure her happiness. On the other hand, Werther had become dear to her. There was a beautiful unanimity of sentiment between them from the very first hour of their acquaintance, and their long association and repeated conversations had made an indelible impression upon her heart. She had been accustomed to communicate to him every thought and feeling which interested her, and his absence threatened to open a void in her existence which it might be impossible to fill. How heartily she wished that she might change him into her brother, that she could induce him to marry one of her own friends, or could restore his intimacy with Albert. She reviewed all her women friends in her mind, but found something objectionable in each, and could decide upon none to whom she would consent to give him. Amid all these considerations, she felt deeply but indistinctly that her own real but unexpressed wish was to retain him for herself, and her pure and amiable heart felt from this thought a sense of oppression which seemed to forbid a prospect of happiness. She was wretched. A dark cloud obscured her mental vision. It was now 6:30, and she heard Werther's step on the stairs. She at once recognized his voice as he inquired if she were at home. Her heart beat audibly. We could almost say for the first time, at his arrival. It was too late to deny herself, and as he entered, she exclaimed with a sort of ill-concealed confusion, "You have not kept your word." "I promise nothing," he answered. "But you should have complied, at least for my sake," she continued. "I implore you, for both our sakes, for the peace of mind of us both." She scarcely knew what she said or did, and sent for a couple of her women friends who, by their presence, might prevent her being left alone with Werther. He put down some books he had brought with him, then made inquiries about some others, until she began to hope that her friends might arrive shortly, entertaining at the same time a desire that they might stay away. The girl came back to say they both sent their apologies. At one moment she felt anxious that the girl should remain in the adjoining room. Then she changed her mind. Werther, meanwhile, walked impatiently up and down. She went to the piano and began a minuet, but it faltered. She then collected her thoughts and sat down quietly at Werther's side, who had taken his usual place on the sofa. "Have you brought nothing to read?" she inquired. He had nothing. "There, in my drawer," she continued, "you will find your own translation of some of the songs of Ossian. I have not yet read them, as I have still hoped to hear you recite them. But for some time past, I have not been able to fulfil such a wish." He smiled and went for the manuscript, which he took with a shudder. He sat down, and with eyes full of tears, he began to read. "Star of descending night, fair is thy light in the west. Thou liftest thy unshorn head from thy cloud. Thy steps are stately on thy hill. What dost thou behold across the moors? The stormy winds are laid. The murmur of the torrent comes from afar. Roaring waves climb the distant rock. The flies of evening are on their feeble wings. The hum of their course is on the field. What dost thou behold, fair light? But thou dost smile and depart. The waves come with joy around thee. They bathe thy lovely hair. Farewell, thou silent beam. Let the light of Ossian's soul arise." And it does arise in its strength. I behold my departed friends. Their gathering is on Laura, as in the days of other years. Fingal comes like a watery column of mist. His heroes are around and see the bards of song. Grey-haired Ullin, stately Rhino, Alpin with the tuneful voice, the soft complaint of Minona. How are ye changed, my friends, since the days of Selma's feast, when we contended like gales of spring as they fly along the hill and bend by turns the feebly whistling grass. Minona came forth in her beauty, with downcast look and tearful eye. Her hair was flying slowly with the blast that rushed unfrequent from the hill. The souls of the heroes were sad when she raised the tuneful voice. Oft had they seen the grave of Salgar, the dark dwelling of white-bosomed Kolmar. Kolmar left alone on the hill with all her voice of song. Salgar promised to come, but the night descended around. Hear the voice of Kolmar when she sat alone on the hill. Kolmar. It is night. I am alone, forlorn on the hill of storms. The wind is heard on the mountain. The torrent is howling down the rock. No hut receives me from the rain, forlorn on the hill of winds. Rise, moon, from behind thy clouds. Stars of the night, arise, lead me some light to the place where my love rests from the chase alone. His bow near him unstrung, his dogs panting round him. But here I must sit alone by the rock of the mossy stream. The stream and the wind roar aloud. I hear not the voice of my love. Why delays my Salgar? Why the chief of the hill his promise? Here is the rock, and here the tree, here is the roaring stream. Thou didst promise with night to be here. Ah, whither is my Salgar gone? With thee I would fly from my father, with thee from my brother of pride. Our race have long been foes. We are not foes, O Salgar. Cease a little while, O wind, stream be thou silent a while, let my voice be heard around, let my wanderer hear me. Salgar, it is Kolmar who calls. Here is the tree and the rock. Salgar, my love, I am here, why delayest thou thy coming? Lo, the calm moon comes forth, the flood is bright in the vale, the rocks are grey on the steep. I see him not on the brow, his dogs come not before him with tidings of his near approach. Here I must sit alone. Who lie on the heath beside me? Are they my love and my brother? Speak to me, O my friends. To Kolmar they give no reply. Speak to me, I am alone. My soul is tormented with fears. Ah, they are dead, their swords are red from the fight. O my brother! My brother, why hast thou slain my Selgar? Why, O Selgar, hast thou slain my brother? Dear were ye both to me. What shall I say in your praise? Thou wert fair on the hill among thousands. He was terrible in fight. Speak to me, hear my voice, hear me, sons of my love. They are silent, silent forever. Cold, cold are their breasts of clay. Oh, from the rock on the hill, from the top of the windy steep, speak, ye ghosts of the dead. Speak, I will not be afraid. Whither are ye gone to rest? In what cave of the hill shall I find the departed? No feeble voice is on the gale, no answer half drowned in the storm. I sit in my grief, I wait for morning in my tears. Rear the tomb, ye friends of the dead, close it not till Colmar come. My life flies away like a dream. Why should I stay behind? Here shall I rest with my friends by the stream of the sounding rock. When night comes on the hill, when the loud winds arise, my ghost shall stand in the blast and mourn the death of my friends. The hunter shall hear from his booth, he shall fear but love my voice. For sweet shall my voice be for my friends. Pleasant were her friends to Colmar. Such was thy song, Minona, softly blushing daughter of Torman. Our tears descended for Colmar, and our souls were sad. Ulin came with his harp. He gave the song of Alpin. The voice of Alpin was pleasant, the soul of Rhino was a beam of fire, but they had rested in the narrow house, their voice had ceased in Selma. Ulin had returned one day from the chase before the heroes fell. He heard their strife on the hill, their song was soft, but sad. They mourned the fall of Morar, first of mortal men. His soul was like the soul of Fingal, his sword like the sword of Oscar. But he fell, and his father mourned. His sister's eyes were full of tears. Minona's eyes were full of tears, the sister of Carborn Morar. She retired from the song of Ulin, like the moon in the west when she foresees the shower, and hides her fair head in a cloud. I touched the harp with Ulin. The song of mourning rose. Rhino. The wind and the rain are past. Calm is the noon of day. The clouds are divided in heaven. Over the green hills flies the inconstant sun. Red through the stony vale comes down the stream of the hill. Sweet are thy murmurs, O stream, but more sweet is the voice I hear. It is the voice of Alpin, the son of song, mourning for the dead. Bent is his head of age, red his tearful eye. Alpin, thou son of song, why alone on the silent hill? Why complainest thou as a blast in the wood, as a wave on the lonely shore? Alpin. My tears, O Rhino, are for the dead, my voice for those that have passed away. Tall thou art on the hill, fair among the sons of the vale, but thou shalt fall like Morar. The mourner shall sit on thy tomb, the hills shall know thee no more. Thy bow shall lie in thy hall unstrung. Thou wert swift, O Morar, as a roe on the hills, terrible as a meteor of fire. Thy wrath was as the storm, thy sword in battle as lightning in the field. Thy voice was as a stream after rain, like thunder on distant hills. Many fell by thy arm. They were consumed in the flames of thy wrath. But when thou didst return from war, how peaceful was thy brow. Thy face was like the sun after rain, like the moon in the silence of night. Calm as the breast of the lake when the loud wind is laid. Narrow is thy dwelling now, dark the place of thine abode. With three steps I compass thy grave. O thou who wast so great before, four stones with their heads of moss are the only memorial of thee. A tree with scarce a leaf, long grass which whistles in the wind, mark to the hunter's eye the grave of the mighty Morar. Morar, thou art low indeed, thou hast no mother to mourn thee, no maid with her tears of love. Dead is she that brought thee forth. Fallen is the daughter of Morglan. Who on his staff leans there? Who is this whose head is white with age, whose eyes are red with tears, who quakes at every step? It is thy father, O Morar, the father of no son but thee. He heard of thy fame in war, he heard of foes dispersed, he heard of Morar's renown. Why did he not hear of his wound? Weep, thou father of Morar, weep, but thy son heareth thee not. Deep is the sleep of the dead, low their pillow of dust. No more shall he hear thy voice, no more awake at thy call. When shall it be morn in the grave, to bid the slumberer awake? Farewell, thou bravest of men, thou conqueror in the field, but the field shall see thee no more, nor the dark wood be lightened with the splendour of thy steel. Thou hast left no son. The song shall preserve thy name. Future times shall hear of thee, they shall hear of the fallen Morar. The grief of all arose, but most the bursting sigh of Armin. He remembers the death of his son, who fell in the days of his youth. Carmor was near the hero, the chief of the echoing Galmal. Why burst the sigh of Armin? He said. Is there a cause to mourn? The song comes with its music to melt and please the soul. It is like soft mist that, rising from a lake, pours on the silent vale. The green flowers are filled with dew, but the sun returns in his strength, and the mist is gone. Why art thou sad, O Armin, chief of sea-surrounded Gorma? Sad I am, nor small is my cause of woe. Carmor, thou hast lost no son, thou hast lost no daughter of beauty. Kolgar the valiant lives, and Anira, fairest maid. The boughs of thy house ascend, O Carmor. But Armin is the last of his race. Dark is thy bed, O Daura. Deep thy sleep in the tomb. When shalt thou wake with thy songs, with all thy voice of music? Arise, winds of autumn, arise, blow along the heath. Streams of the mountains, roar, roar, tempests in the groves of my oaks. Walk through broken clouds, O moon, show thy pale face at intervals. Bring to my mind the night when all my children fell, when Arindal the mighty fell, when Daura the lovely failed. Daura, my daughter, thou wert fair, fair as the moon on Fura, white as the driven snow, sweet as the breathing gale. Arindal, thy bow was strong, thy spear was swift on the field, thy look was like mist on the wave, thy shield a red cloud in a storm. Armar, renowned in war, came and sought Daura's love. He was not long refused. Fair was the hope of their friends. Erath, son of Odgal, repined. His brother had been slain by Armar. He came disguised like a son of the sea. Fair was his cliff on the wave, white his locks of age, calm his serious brow. Fairest of women, he said, lovely daughter of Armin, a rock not distant in the sea bears a tree on its side. Red shines the fruit afar. There Armar waits for Daura. I come to carry his love. She went, she called on Armar. Nought answered, but the son of the rock. Armar, my love, why tormentest thou me with fear? Hear, son of Arnat, hear, it is Daura who calleth thee. Erath the traitor fled laughing to the land. She lifted up her voice, she called for her brother and her father. Arindal, Armin, none to relieve you, Daura. Her voice came over the sea. Arindal, my son, descended from the hill, rough in the spoils of the chase. His arrows rattled by his side, his bow was in his hand. Five dark grey dogs attended his steps. He saw fierce Erath on the shore. He seized and bound him to an oak. Thick wind the thongs of the hide around his limbs. He loads the winds with his groans. Arindal ascends the deep in his boat to bring Daura to land. Armar came in his wrath and let fly the grey-feathered shaft. It sung, it sunk in thy heart, O Arendal, my son, for Erath the traitor, thou diest. The oar is stopped at once. He panted on the rock and expired. What is thy grief, O Daura, when round thy feet is poured thy brother's blood? The boat is broken in twain. Armar plunges into the sea to rescue his Daura or die. Suddenly a blast from a hill came over the waves. He sank, and he rose no more. Alone, on the sea-beat rock, my daughter was heard to complain. Frequent and loud were her cries. What could her father do? All night I stood on the shore. I saw her by the faint beam of the moon. All night I heard her cries. Loud was the wind. The rain beat hard on the hill. Before morning appeared, her voice was weak. It died away like the evening breeze among the grass of the rocks. Spent with grief, she expired and left thee, Armin, alone. Gone is my strength in war, fallen my pride among women. When the storms aloft arise, when the north lifts the wave on high, I sit by the sounding shore and look on the fatal rock. Often by the setting moon I see the ghosts of my children. Half viewless they walk in mournful conference together. The Editor to the Reader. A torrent of tears which streamed from Lotta's eyes and gave relief to her bursting heart stopped Werther's recitation. He threw down the book, seized her hand and wept bitterly. Lotta leaned upon her hand and buried her face in her handkerchief. The agitation of both was excessive. They felt that their own fate was pictured in the misfortunes of Ossian's heroes. They felt this together, and their tears redoubled. Werther supported his forehead on Lotta's arm. She trembled. She wished to be gone, but sorrow and sympathy lay like a leaden weight upon her soul. She recovered herself shortly and begged Werther with broken sobs to leave her, implored him with the utmost earnestness to comply with her request. He trembled. His heart was ready to burst. Then, taking up the book again, he started to read again, in a voice broken by sobs.
Why dost thou waken me, O heirs of spring? Thy voice woos me, exclaiming, I refresh thee with heavenly dews. But the time of my decay is approaching. The storm is nigh that shall wither my leaves. Tomorrow the traveller shall come. He shall come, who beheld me in beauty. His eye shall seek me in the field around. But he shall not find me.
The whole force of these words fell upon the unfortunate Werther. Full of despair, he threw himself at Lotta's feet, seized her hands and pressed them to his eyes and to his forehead. An apprehension of his fatal project now struck her for the first time. Her senses were bewildered. She held his hands, pressed them to her bosom, and leaning towards him with emotions of the tenderest pity, her warm cheek touched his. They lost sight of everything. The world disappeared from their eyes. He clasped her in his arms, strained her to his heart, and covered her trembling lips with passionate kisses.
Werther,
she cried with a faint voice, turning herself away.
Werther.
And with a feeble hand she pushed him from her. At length, with the firm voice of virtue, she exclaimed,
Werther.
He did not resist, but tearing himself from her arms, fell on his knees before her. Lotta rose, and with disordered grief, in mingled tones of love and resentment, she exclaimed,
It is the last time, Werther. You shall never see me any more.
Then, casting one last tender look upon her unfortunate lover, she rushed into the adjoining room and locked the door. Werther held out his arms, but did not dare to detain her. He continued on the ground with his head resting on the sofa for half an hour, till he heard a noise which brought him to his senses. The servant girl entered. He then walked up and down the room, and when he was again left alone, he went to Lotta's door and in a low voice said,
Lotta, Lotta.
but one word more, one last farewell." She returned no answer. He stopped and listened and entreated, but all was silent. At length he tore himself from the place, crying,
"Goodbye, Lotta. Goodbye. Forever."
Werther ran to the town gates. The watchmen, who knew him, let him pass in silence. The night was dark and stormy, somewhere between rain and snow. He reached his own door about 11. His servant, although seeing him enter the house without his hat, did not venture to say anything, and as he undressed his master, he found that his clothes were wet. His hat was afterwards found on the point of a rock overhanging the valley, and it is inconceivable how he could have climbed to the summit on such a dark, tempestuous night without losing his life. He went to bed and slept to a late hour. The next morning his servant, upon being called to bring his coffee, found him writing. He was adding the following to his letter to Lotta: "For the last time I open these eyes. Oh, they will behold the sun no more. It is covered by a thick, impenetrable cloud. Yes, nature, put on mourning. Your child, your friend, your lover, draws near his end. This thought, Lotta, is without parallel, and yet it seems like a mysterious dream when I repeat, this is my last day. The last, Lotta. No word can adequately express this thought. The last. Today I stand upright in all my strength, and tomorrow, cold and stark, I shall lie extended upon the ground. To die? What is death? We do but dream in our discourse upon it. I have seen human beings die, but so straitened is our feeble nature, we have no clear conception of the beginning or the end of our existence. At this moment, I am my own, or rather, I am yours, yours, my beloved, and the next we are parted, severed, perhaps forever. No, Lotta, no. How can I, how can you, cease to be? We are. What is annihilation? A mere word, an unmeaning sound that fixes no impression on the mind. Dead, Lotta, laid in the cold earth, in the dark and narrow grave. I had a friend once who was everything to me in early youth. She died. I followed her hearse. I stood by her grave when the coffin was lowered, and when I heard the creaking of the cords as they were loosened and drawn up, when the first shovelful of earth was thrown in, and the coffin returned a hollow sound, which grew fainter and fainter till all was completely covered over, I threw myself on the ground. My heart was smitten, grieved, shattered, rent. But I neither knew what had happened, nor what was to happen to me. Death. The grave. I do not know the words. Forgive. Oh, forgive me. Yesterday. Ah, that day should have been the last of my life. Oh, you angel. For the first time in my existence, I felt rapture glow within my inmost soul. She loves. She loves me. Still burns upon my lips the sacred fire they received from yours. New torrents of delight overwhelm my soul. Forgive me, oh, forgive. I knew that I was dear to you. I saw it in your first entrancing look. Knew it by the first pressure of your hand. But when I was absent from you, when I saw Albert at your side, my doubts and fears returned. Do you remember the flowers you sent me, when, at that dull gathering, you could neither speak nor extend your hand to me? Half the night I was on my knees before those flowers, and I regarded them as the pledges of your love, but those impressions grew fainter, and were, at length, effaced. Everything passes away, but a whole eternity could not extinguish the living flame which was yesterday kindled by your lips, and which now burns within me. She loves me. These arms have encircled her waist. These lips have trembled upon hers. She is mine. Yes, Lotta, you are mine forever. And what do they mean by saying Albert is your husband? He may be so for this world, and in this world it is a sin to love you, to wish to tear you from his embrace. Yes, it is a crime, and I suffer the punishment. But I have enjoyed the full delight of my sin. I have inhaled a balm that has revived my soul. From this hour you are mine. Yes, Lotta, you are mine. I go before you. I go to my father and to your father. I will pour out my sorrows before him, and he will give me comfort till you arrive. Then will I fly to meet you. I will claim you and remain your eternal embrace, in the presence of the Almighty. I do not dream, I do not rave. Drawing nearer to the grave, my perceptions become clearer. We shall exist, we shall see each other again. We shall behold your mother, I shall behold her, and expose to her my inmost heart. Your mother, your image. Towards 11 o'clock, Werther asked his servant if Albert had returned. He answered yes, for he had seen him pass on horseback, upon which Werther sent him the following note, unsealed. Would you mind lending me your pistols for a journey I intend to take? Farewell. Lotta had slept little during the past night. All her apprehensions were realized in a way that she could neither foresee nor avoid. Her blood was boiling in her veins, and 1,000 painful sensations rent her pure heart. Was it the ardor of Werther's passionate embraces that she felt within her bosom? Was it anger at his daring? Was it the sad comparison of her present condition with former days of innocence, tranquility, and self-confidence? How could she approach her husband and confess a scene which she had no reason to conceal, and which she yet felt, nevertheless, unwilling to confess? They had preserved so long a silence towards each other, and should she be the first to break it by so unexpected a discovery? She feared that the mere statement of Werther's visit would trouble him, and his distress would be heightened by her perfect candour. She wished that he could see her in her true light, and judge her without prejudice. But was she anxious that he should read her inmost soul? On the other hand, could she deceive a being to whom all her thoughts had ever been exposed as clearly as crystal, and from whom no sentiment had ever been concealed? These reflections made her anxious and thoughtful. Her mind still dwelt on Werther, who was now lost to her, but whom she could not bring herself to resign, and for whom she knew nothing was left but despair, if she should be lost to him for ever. A recollection of that mysterious estrangement which had lately occurred between herself and Albert, and which she could never thoroughly understand, was now beyond measure painful to her. Even the prudent and the good have before now hesitated to explain their mutual differences, and have dwelt in silence upon their imaginary grievances, until circumstances have become so entangled that in that critical juncture, when a calm explanation would have saved all parties, an understanding was impossible. And thus, if domestic confidence had been earlier established between them, if love and kind forbearance had mutually animated and expanded their hearts, it might not, perhaps, even yet have been too late to save our friend. But we must not forget one remarkable circumstance. We may observe from the character of Werther's correspondence that he had never affected to conceal his anxious desire to quit this world. He had often discussed the subject with Albert, and between the latter and Lotta, it had not unfrequently formed a topic of conversation. Albert was so opposed to the very idea of such an action that, with the degree of irritation unusual in him, He had more than once given Werther to understand that he doubted the seriousness of his threats, and not only turned them into ridicule, but caused Lotta to share his feelings of scepticism. Her heart was therefore calmed when she felt disposed to view the melancholy subject in a serious point of view, though she never communicated to her husband the anxieties she sometimes felt. Albert, upon his return, was received by Lotta with ill-concealed embarrassment. He was himself out of humour, his business was unfinished, and he had just discovered that the neighbouring official with whom he had to deal was an obstinate and narrow-minded gentleman. The bad roads had only added to his annoyance. He asked if anything had happened during his absence, and Lotta hastily answered that Werther had been there the previous evening. He then inquired for his letters, and was told that several packages had been left in his study. He then withdrew, leaving Lotta alone. The presence of the being she loved and honoured produced a new impression on her heart. The recollection of his generosity, kindness and affection had calmed her agitation. A secret impulse prompted her to follow him. She took her work and went to his study, as was often her custom. He was busily employed opening and reading his letters. It seemed as if the contents of some were disagreeable. She asked some questions, he gave short answers, and sat down to write. Several hours passed in this manner, and Lotta's feelings became more and more melancholy. She felt the extreme difficulty of explaining to her husband, under any circumstances, the weight that lay upon her heart, and her depression became every moment greater in proportion as she endeavoured to hide her grief and to conceal her tears. The arrival of Werther's servant occasioned her the greatest consternation. He gave Albert a note, which the latter coldly handed to his wife, saying at the same time, "Give him the pistols. I wish him a pleasant journey," he added, turning to the servant. These words fell upon Lotta like a thunderstroke. She rose from her seat, half fainting and unconscious of what she did. She walked mechanically towards the wall, took down the pistols with a trembling hand, slowly wiped the dust from them, and would have delayed longer had not Albert hastened her movements by an impatient look. She then delivered the fatal weapons to the servant, without being able to utter a word. As soon as he had departed, she folded up her work and retired at once to her room, her heart overcome with the most fearful forebodings. She anticipated some dreadful calamity. She was at one moment on the point of going to her husband, throwing herself at his feet and acquainting him with all that had happened on the previous evening, that she might acknowledge her fault and explain her apprehensions. Then she saw that such a step would be useless, as she would certainly be unable to induce Albert to visit Werther. Dinner was served, and a kind friend whom she had persuaded to remain assisted to sustain the conversation, which was carried on by a sort of compulsion, till the events of the morning were forgotten. When the servant brought the pistols to Werther, the latter received them with transports of delight upon hearing that Lotta had given them to him with her own hand. He ate some bread, drank some wine, sent his servant to dinner, and then sat down to write as follows. "They have been in your hands. You wiped the dust from them. I kissed them 1,000 times. You have touched them. Yes, heaven favours my design, and you, Lotta, provide me with the fatal instruments. It was my desire to receive my death from your hands, and my wish is gratified. I have made inquiries of my servant. You trembled when you gave him the pistols, but you bade me no adieu. Wretched, wretched that I am, not one farewell. How could you shut your heart against me in that hour which makes you mine forever? Lotte, 1,000 years cannot efface the impression. I feel you cannot hate the man who so passionately loves you." After dinner he called his servant, desired him to finish the packing, destroyed many papers, and then went out to pay some trifling debts. He soon returned home, then went out again, despite the rain, walked for some time in the Count's garden, and afterwards proceeded farther into the country. At nightfall he came back once more, and resumed his writing. Wilhelm, I have looked for the last time on the fields, the woods, and the sky. Farewell. And you, my dearest mother, forgive me. Console her, Wilhelm. God bless you. I have settled all my affairs. Farewell. We shall meet again, and be happier than ever. I have requited you badly, Albert, but you will forgive me. I have disturbed the peace of your home. I have sowed distrust between you. Farewell. I will end all this wretchedness, and oh, that my death may render you happy. Albert, Albert, make that angel happy, and the blessing of heaven be upon you. He spent the rest of the evening arranging his papers. He tore and burned a great many, others he sealed up and directed to Wilhelm. They contained some short essays, abstract thoughts and maxims, some of which I have seen. At 10 o'clock he ordered his fire to be made up, and a bottle of wine to be brought to him. He then dismissed his servant, whose room as well as the sleeping quarters of the rest of the family was situated in another part of the house. The servant lay down without undressing, that he might be the sooner ready for his journey in the morning, his master having informed him that the post-horses would be at the door before 6 o'clock. After 11. All is silent around me, and my soul is calm. I thank thee, O God, that thou bestowest strength and courage upon me in these my last moments. I approach the window, my dearest of friends, and through the clouds, which are at this moment driven rapidly along by the impetuous winds, I see the stars which light the eternal heavens. No, you will not fall, celestial bodies. The hand of the Almighty supports both you and me. I have looked for the last time upon the constellation of the Plough. It is my favourite star, for when I bade you farewell at night, Lotta, and turned my steps from your door, it always shone upon me. With what elation I have at times beheld it! How often have I implored it with uplifted hands to witness my happiness! And even still... But what is there, Lotta, which fails to summon up your image before me? Do you not surround me on all sides? And have I not, like a child, treasured up every trifle which you have consecrated by your touch? Your silhouette, which was so dear to me, I return to you, and I pray you preserve it. Thousands of kisses have I imprinted upon it, and a thousand times has it gladdened my heart on departing from and returning to my home. I have implored your father to protect my body. At the corner of the churchyard, looking towards the fields, there are two lime trees. There I wish to lie. Your father can, and doubtless will, do this much for his friend. Implore it of him. But perhaps pious Christians will not choose that their bodies should be buried near the corpse of a poor unhappy wretch like me. Then let me be laid in some remote valley, or by the wayside where the priest and Levite may bless themselves as they pass by my tomb, whilst the Samaritan will shed a tear for my fate. See, Lotta, I do not shudder to take the cold and fatal cup from which I shall drink the draught of death. Your hand presents it to me, and I do not tremble. All is now concluded. The wishes and the hopes of my existence are fulfilled. With cold, unflinching hand I knock at the brazen portals of death. Oh, that I had enjoyed the bliss of dying for you! How gladly would I have sacrificed myself for you, Lotta! And could I but restore peace and joy to your bosom, with what resolution, with what joy would I not meet my fate! But it is the lot of only a chosen few to shed their blood for their friends, and quicken, by their death, new life for their friends 100 times over. I wish, Lotta, to be buried in these clothes. You have touched them, and rendered them sacred by your touch. I have begged this favour of your father. my spirit soars above my coffin. Let nobody search my pockets. The knot of pale red ribbon which you wore on your bosom the first time I saw you, surrounded by the children. Oh, kiss them 1,000 times for me, and tell them the fate of their unhappy friend. I think I see them playing around me. The dear children. How warmly have I been attached to you, Lotta. Since the first hour I saw you, how impossible have I found it to leave you. This ribbon must be buried with me. It was a present from you on my birthday. How confused it all appears. Little did I then think that I should journey this road. But peace, I pray you, peace. They are loaded. The clock strikes 12. I say amen. Lotta. Lotta. Farewell. Farewell. A neighbour saw the flash and heard the report of the pistol. But as everything remained quiet, he thought no more of it. In the morning at 6 o'clock, the servant went into Werther's room with a candle. He found his master stretched upon the floor, the pistols, and the blood. He called, he took him in his arms, but received no answer, only a rattle in his throat. The servant ran for a surgeon and then went to fetch Albert. Lotta heard the ringing of the bell. A cold shudder seized her. She wakened her husband and they both rose. The servant, stammering and crying, gave them the news. Lotta fell unconscious at Albert's feet. When the surgeon came to the unfortunate Werther, he was still lying on the floor, and his pulse beat, but his limbs were cold. The bullet, entering the forehead over the right eye, had blown his brains out. A vein was opened in his right arm. The blood came, and he still continued to breathe. From the blood which flowed from the chair, it could be inferred that he had committed the rash act sitting at his writing desk, and that he afterwards fell upon the floor. He was found lying on his back near the window, his strength completely drained away, fully clothed with his boots on, in the blue frock coat and buff yellow waistcoat. The house, the neighbourhood, and the whole town were immediately in commotion. Albert arrived. They had laid Werther on the bed, his forehead bound up, and the paleness of death was upon his face. His limbs were motionless, but he was still breathing with a terrible rattling on his lungs, at one time strongly, now weaker. His death was expected at any time. He had drunk only one glass of the wine. Emilia Galotti lay open upon his desk. I shall say nothing of Albert's distress, or of Lotta's grief. The old land steward hastened to the house immediately upon hearing the news. He embraced his dying friend amid a flood of tears. His eldest boys soon followed him on foot. In speechless sorrow they threw themselves on their knees by the bedside and kissed his hands and face. The eldest, who was his favourite, hung over him till he expired, and even then he was removed by force. At 12 o'clock, Werther breathed his last. The presence of the steward, and the measures he had taken, prevented a disturbance. And that night, at the hour of 11, he had the body buried in the place Werther had chosen for himself. The steward and his sons followed the corpse to the grave. Albert was unable to accompany them. They feared for Lotta's life. The body was carried by labourers. No priest attended.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.